What a pleasure to have you with us on the Jim Bohannon Show from the Dial Global Radio Network. We're at 1-866-50-JIMBO, 1-866-505-4626. Online, we're at jimbotalk.net. Thank you for joining us tonight. Arab Spring. Oh, boy. What started as Arab Spring has become, in some cases, the winter of their discontent. And nowhere is that more evident, unless you count the civil war in Syria, than in Egypt, the largest, by far the largest, of the Arab countries, and a place where Arab Spring has left some feeling somewhat betrayed. There was, of course, the initial moves that led finally to the ouster and ultimately imprisonment of the ill former President Hosni Mubarak. Then the Muslim Brotherhood came forward, first saying, well, we don't really want to do much, or just sort of maybe a cabinet post, and then Well, maybe majority in the parliament. Well, maybe the presidency. Well, maybe a new constitution. That didn't last long. In any event, now you've got a lot of student groups who were those who were in the streets in Cairo in the first place, who are not too happy with this new constitution. And then you've got the military, which has always been a key player in Egypt, and they got seriously slapped down by the new Egyptian president, Mohamed Morsi, not long ago. Their place in all of this still unclear. But there are other bigger questions about where this is all headed and what it could ultimately lead to. And we're going to be talking about that tonight with a Middle Eastern expert. He is Professor Raymond Stock, who is a fellow at the Middle East Forum, former visiting assistant professor of Arabic at Drew University, as well as Middle Eastern Studies. Currently is writing a biography of the Egyptian Nobel Prize winner in literature, Naguib Mahfouz. Mr. Stock spent over 20 years of his life in Egypt before being deported in 2010 for writing an article criticizing anti-Israel and anti-Semitic statements made by a government minister. All right, Raymond Stock, thank you for joining us tonight.
Thanks very much for having me, Jim. I really appreciate being here.
This, certainly, for one thing, I'm curious. Did the Muslim Brotherhood really have a gradual change of heart through this entire Arab Spring process? Or, thank you. Yes, that was my response to that. I felt it was a question.
The response I just had should have been the response of all the media and all the experts.
And beyond that, maybe all of the people at the State Department?
And them included. I mean, actually, a lot of people on the ground in the State Department in various countries, including, no doubt, in Egypt, are quite aware of what's going on. And one thing we did learn from the WikiLeaks scandal, one of the only positive thing in it was we learned how very good some of our diplomats can be in reporting what goes on overseas. Unfortunately, what they say is not often listened to by their superiors in Washington.
Yeah.
But to go back to the specifics of your question, the Muslim Brotherhood is now at the end, or very, very near what they think is the end of an 84-year journey of theirs, plodding patiently like a camel across the sands of the Egyptian desert to power in the greatest Arab country. As you had a very good introduction. I really liked it. That is a very, very important point. These people have created a worldwide organization that had its origins in Egypt in 1928. And they were originally, you know, they came out of the Salafi library. They're a very radical Islamist group from the very beginning.
I remember since the 1979 the Iranian Revolution and the hostage-taking crisis there, and my goodness, that's been now coming up on almost 24 years, we have been in search of the elusive Iranian moderate mullah. And I'm wondering, have we also been on a similar quixotic quest here trying to find the elusive moderate member of the Muslim Brotherhood?
They don't exist.
So this whole thing was a con job from day one, and we actually bid for it. We fell for it.
Yes, I wrote a piece about this in July for the Foreign Policy Research Institute called The Donkey, the Camel, and the Facebook Scam, which is all about this particular point. I mean, how they very carefully conned everyone into thinking that they were not interested in seizing state power, that they really weren't part of the revolution in the beginning, which they were. They were actually an integral part of it from the very beginning, and particularly from the second day of demonstrations when they dominated them entirely. It took their organization and their network to bring those people out into the squares and streets of Egypt that helped bring down Mubarak. Of course, it was the army that actually brought him down. But people also failed to realize how much they were in collusion with the military. The military itself is I mean, I have my own sources. They're riddled. The military is riddled with the Muslim Brotherhood sympathizers.
Really?
And members. And the staff around Mohammed Hossein Tantawi, the former chief of staff, or the former head of the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces that ruled Egypt during the transition.
But removed by
Morsi, yes, I'm sorry?
I was going to say, we can trot out another piece of conventional wisdom at this point, and that is that as the Muslim Brotherhood began to exert more and more pressure on the results of the ouster of Mubarak, the conventional wisdom said, well, don't worry, the Egyptian military will keep them in check.
Yes, I remember that. Yeah. Well, they weren't even interested in that. They were interested in keeping him in check to a degree, because they have different... Even though they have sympathy with Islamist aims, say in general, many of them, not all of them, many of them are just career army officers and military people, but many of them were Mubarak loyalists, in fact, at the time that he took power, Morsi took power. But the majority of their staff people and the rank and file and the mid-level officers, from what I've been hearing from people, my own sources as well, they were really quite sympathetic in general to the Islamist cause. So I really think that it was a matter of time before they came together. There was a confluence of interests there. And what Morsi, the biggest problem that the Muslim Brotherhood had with the military and vice versa, was that the Muslim Brotherhood wanted to jail some of the members of the SCAF, of the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces that ruled the country after Mubarak, because they had been close to Mubarak.
Well, now that's the part I don't quite understand, I guess, is how there is this this common interest that the two have in most parts of the Arab world, I gather, as Arab Spring has dawned, or at least bubbled, thinking about dawning at some later date, generally the forces that are contending in many cases would be the military on the one hand and Islamic fundamentalists on the other hand. And I wasn't aware that the two always got along that well, that in fact, in most cases, the military had been hand in glove with the suppression of these Islamist groups. And that they didn't really get along that well or have that much in common. Am I incorrect, or is Egypt an anomaly?
Well, no, I think there's an element of truth on both sides. The thing is that there were lots of sympathizers, but the top people in the SCAF were not necessarily Islamists, or they definitely had some Islamist leanings. I mean, they brought the Sheikh from Qatar. Yusuf al-Qaradawi, who's the most important and popular preacher of the Muslim Brotherhood, and in fact in the Islamic world, or at least in the Arabic-speaking Muslim world. And they brought him as the person to address the big victory rally. The military had to either invite him or at least consent. They provided security for him when he arrived to speak at Tahrir Square on the first Friday after the fall of Mubarak. Mubarak fell on a Friday. The next Friday, February 18th, they had Yusuf al-Qaradawi speaking in Tahrir to the biggest crowd ever seen there. And he was talking about what? Liberating Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm. We're going to come back and we're going to be talking about just exactly what this agenda is and other aspects of where this could all be going, because we could very well be on the verge of the complete consolidation of the absolute power of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. Our guest again is Middle Eastern expert Professor Raymond Stock. He is a visiting professor of Arabic and Middle East Studies, former visiting professor of Arabic and Middle East Studies at Drew University. He is a fellow at the Middle East Forum, and again, a person who spent 20 years of his life in Egypt before being deported in 2010. We'll ask him about that aspect of his life as well. And one other little cheery prospect for you to digest as we pause briefly, and that would be Egyptian nukes? Question mark. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Jim Bohannon Show at 1-866-50-JIMBO, 1-866-505-4626. So, surprise, surprise, surprise. The Muslim Brotherhood wasn't entirely serious about that hanging back and just kind of watching what was happening in Egypt. Middle Eastern expert Professor Raymond Stock is our guest. So, if in fact there is a Muslim Brotherhood agenda and the other principal power center in Egypt, the military, has some elements leaning strongly in the direction of that agenda, maybe it's time we all learn just what that agenda really is.
Well, I wanted to talk just for a moment about the relationship between these players, the military, the Muslim Brotherhood, and also our own government, because our own government, and particularly President Obama, directly, more or less, ordered President Mubarak out on February 10th of last year. The next day he was gone. He just said, we want this transition to go faster. And the next day, the people of Egypt expected to go faster. And then the next day he was gone. The army had decided to take him out at that point. And even before Mubarak fell, there was a relationship between the opposition and the army that was led by the Muslim Brotherhood already. They were heading the negotiations for the opposition. So already we saw something going on there. And then, lo and behold, they decided to get involved in the elections, as you pointed out, and they kept breaking their word as to how far they would go. They went all the way, finally. They took the presidency, possibly in a rigged vote. And the military occasionally would have a little tiff with the Brotherhood along the way, but most of the time they worked very closely together. And the other opposition groups, who were genuine opposition groups, were always complaining about the Brotherhood's relationship with the military.
Well, let me ask you about that recent purge.
You should not be surprised by this. But let me go back just one
second. Okay, before you go back, let me just ask you a bit about that recent purge in which the leadership of the military was sacked by Morsi. That obviously wasn't planned by those leaders.
Well, as a matter of fact, I think it was all set up, more or less. I mean, the precise timing, I don't think, was. But, because Morsi took advantage of an embarrassment that happened to the military when 15 Egyptian soldiers were killed on August 5th in a failed attack to kill the Israelis inside Israel launched from Sinai. So Morsi seized the opportunity to purge the military. But he already had something going there. They were already in discussions. And those discussions, it turns out, were apparently facilitated by the White House. The White House actually helped get the military out of the way for Morsi. And they also helped.
Was that a smart move?
Mubarak out of the way. So they have been, and the point I want to make about going back before that process was that back on June 4th, 2009, that I believe was the real launch date of the Egyptian revolution, of the January 25th revolution, as it's been called. That was the date that President Obama gave a speech at Cairo University, sponsored by Cairo University, and Al-Azhar University, the biggest Islamic Sunni center of learning in the world. And he gave a speech where he invited the Muslim Brotherhood to be there in the front row. They were an illegal organization. And that, by doing that, he excluded his host, the president of Egypt, at the time our second biggest ally and our second most important ally in the Middle East. I mean, after Israel, he's the second most important. So he was saying to them, you are the future, by doing that. He was the person who launched this revolution, in my opinion.
Well, now, I'm just wondering, what would we hear if we were a fly on the wall of the Oval Office or the inner sanctums over in Foggy Bottom, the State Department? Would we be hearing things like, but they promised? I'm wondering if it's that level of naivete or something more sinister here. I mean, I cannot believe that anybody in this administration would be in favor of the direction that we're going, so I'm leaning toward naivete.
Well, I think he has a lot of people around him, including some Islamists and pro-Islamist people in his administration who advise him very badly in many ways. And I think this is part of that.
All right, now then, you mentioned
background, personal background, and also the kind of people he therefore logically chose to surround himself with in the White House.
So is that the view? I mean, the same president who is still taking out Al-Qaeda leaders with drone strikes and who gave the okay to take out Osama bin Laden? Are we talking here about the same president? I can't believe in his heart of hearts he's an Islamist. I mean,
I don't believe he's in his heart of heart an Islamist. I believe that he is of the mistaken opinion that the Muslim Brotherhood is a bulwark against the more serious Islamists, the more radical and dangerous Islamists.
So that's our choice, worse.
Pardon?
That's our choice, bad and worse?
There was another choice all along, and that was to back the secular liberals, who got no help from us whatsoever during the process.
Well, now that I don't understand. I always assumed, and again, maybe this is my naivete bleeding through here, but I always assumed that the only times that we were not backing the secular liberal voices in the Middle East would be in cases in which there were just too few of them to matter, that if they were ever a viable option, that they would always be our first choice. Am I wrong again?
There is an element of thinking that something in the left-wing anti-imperialist worldview is at work here.
But you know, these left-wingers are the very people their viewpoints in these countries, it is their viewpoints that get suppressed the most and the quickest.
Which ones? I'm talking about the
people who would be considered Western leftists are the very people with the viewpoints that get suppressed the most and the quickest by Islamic fundamentalists.
Well, that's the irony of their position. Their position is illogical given that fact. But they also fail to point out that women are more oppressed, that gays are more oppressed.
Matter of fact,
all sorts of things happen to those people that would be on the single. I mean, just imagine if a Republican did any of these things.
Well, seriously,
talk about war on women.
Try to explain to me, if you would. I mean, these people aren't stupid. I have serious questions about their judgment, but I mean, surely what we just said has not escaped their notice that gays and women don't get treated too well under these influences.
Of course, they should have noticed, but they stubbornly, it seems, fail to criticize it or to give it much weight. And I don't understand why, except that I do sort of understand why, and that is because it fits their worldview more neatly. That those who have been demonized, as they think, by the West and by our establishment, are inherently they have the superior virtue of the oppressed.
Okay. Well, I mean, I shouldn't laugh. That's not an uncommon view. Now, you mentioned this speech in regards to taking Jerusalem. Again, I'm sure there are a lot of people who figured, well, he's speaking metaphorically, or he's speaking for the local audience. He doesn't really mean that.
Well, that's nonsense. He speaks globally. He's speaking to everyone.
And literally?
Literally.
In other words, you're saying that it is the view of the leadership of Egypt that Israel should be pushed into the sea?
Yes.
In other words,
they're not going to say it while they're getting American weapons and aid and building up to the day when they feel they can launch their attack. They're just going to wait.
That almost makes my next question moot, but I feel compelled to ask it. I gather this is bad news for the Camp David Accords. Cue the laughter.
Well, yes, it's pretty bad news.
We've been giving a lot of money.
I don't blame them for not wanting to jump the gun on this.
We've been giving a lot of money to Egypt, a ton of money, and most of it amounted to bribe money in exchange for signing those Camp David Accords. Now, I assume that the quid pro quo is still in effect. Would not the eradication of the Camp David Accords mean an end to all of those American dollars?
Yes, but look at it this way. We're no longer their main piggy bank. In fact, have been very carefully leveraging other options. And since Morsi has taken power, he's actually gotten pledges of much, much more money than we'll ever consider giving Egypt.
From who?
Even without our fiscal cliff.
From who?
Well, $18.5 billion in investments have been pledged by Qatar, which is also the main bankroller of the Muslim Brotherhood worldwide at this point.
That is a Gulf state for those who haven't kept score.
Sir?
I was just explaining to folks, for those who don't keep score in the Middle East, that is a Gulf oil state. Got her. Okay, go ahead.
They have also been pledged $4.8 billion from the IMF in a loan. They've also gotten a $6.4 billion loan pledged to them by the European Union, which has gone out of its way to state that they will not be swayed by an Egyptian internal politics over this loan. The IMF loan's been delayed slightly, apparently, but it's still going to go through, apparently. And the Saudis have also pledged several billion dollars.
All right. Well, hold on to your list. We'll flesh it out and continue in just a moment on the Jim Bohannon Show. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Jim Bohannon Show at 1-866-50-JIMBO, 1-866-505-4626. And online, you'll find us at jimbotalk.net. And we're talking about the situation in Egypt right now with an expert in that region, Raymond Stock, formerly a professor of Middle Eastern Studies at Drew University, a fellow at the Middle Eastern Forum, and a man who obviously does not shrink away from his viewpoints about the Muslim Brotherhood in that region. As the break intervened, you were cataloging the list of people who are lined up to replace those American military dollars that we have pledged to Egypt, which are to this point contingent on the continuation of the Camp David Accords. Go ahead.
Hi. Well, it's very important that the word military, because I think the key element of our assistance to Egypt is military. And so long as we're the main source of their new military technology and maintaining their military forces as they are, as well as building and helping them build up towards bigger and better forces, we do have a slight amount of leverage, perhaps. I don't think we have as much by any means as we had before.
But if they, you know, if they're getting tons of money elsewhere,
money,
I'm sure the Chinese, but money is fungible. Money can be spent on a lot of things. I'm sure that the Chinese would be more than happy to offer some assistance, wouldn't they?
Well, I think the Chinese, after they've stolen our technology, would be very glad to give them our technology that way. But this was probably going to be happening. As a matter of fact, Morsi has asked for $3 billion from the Chinese for his nuclear program.
Yeah, and that brings up, of course, the next element that I was going to ask you about here, and that is whether or not Egypt might be thinking seriously about getting nuclear weapons. Obviously, they're a big country. They're a country that's lived in the shadow of the Israeli nuclear threat now through several conflicts in the Middle East. And not lacking in their resources, I guess, in this regard, either for buying or maybe even building such a device. Are they interested?
Well, you know, officially, of course, they're not going to say they're interested in a nuclear weapon. They in fact, are leading a drive for what they say is weapons of mass destruction free zone in the Middle East, along with Iran. So that tells you how serious that might be.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing is that they've had a program for a very long time, a nuclear program that at its inception was inspired in December 1953 by the Atoms for Peace speech made by Dwight Eisenhower at the United Nations. And so the Americans had originally inspired their nuclear program under Gamal Abdel Nasser, who was ultimately a very radically anti-American leader. And as you pointed out, this idea that the Israelis having nuclear weapons was the spur, allegedly, you know, for their deciding to get nuclear weapons. They tried to get nuclear weapons openly in the 60s under Nasser.
Mm-hmm.
But I would argue that there's never been a threat. I mean, I'm sure you didn't mean it literally, but there was a threat from the Israelis are not threatening anybody. They don't even acknowledge they've got them.
Well, no, they don't acknowledge they've got them, and certainly Israel has no vested interest in using them except as a very last ditch. I mean, that's the kind of thing that they unleash. I guess, for example, in 1973, when the Egyptians smashed their way into Sinai and they had the new Soviet air defense missile shield that shot down a lot of Israeli jets, and the Syrians were pushing hard on the Golan Heights, and there were serious questions about whether or not it was really back to the wall time. And it is my understanding that in fact, at that juncture, Israel reached for the key and said, keep this handy. We may just have to unlock those nukes. Is that correct?
Well, yes, and also the Americans and the Russians went on nuclear alert.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. In fact, it was at that point that after the Russians said, either you, the United States, call off the Israelis, or we'll go in and call them off ourselves, that, in fact, the 73 war came to an end. But right. The point, obviously, being that Israel has no vested interest in using them except just to stay there.
Yeah, but listen to this. An Egyptian a retired general went on TV twice in the last 2 years on a satellite television station in Cairo, saying that that he wanted that Egypt should have a nuclear weapons program that should be covert. It should be on the Iranian model,
mm-hmm.
Using other words, fooling the inspectors, and that you know they should have a nuclear weapon so that they could, if they had a situation where they would force the Israelis to use their nuclear deterrent, they would have one to counter it.
Yeah.
In other words, it was actually envisioning an aggressive attack by Egypt on Israel that would trigger a nuclear response by Israel that they would be able to counter.
Technically speaking now, in terms of technology, the Iranians, of course, have been working for quite some time here on this. The Iranians, I know at one point, had a considerable body of technical expertise, and of course the nuclear genie has been out of the bottle for a long time now, over 60 years, and I've had experts on this program tell me that there are probably several thousand grad students in the world who, given a pretty good machine shop, and most importantly, of course, the fissionable material, they could go a long way towards building a nuclear device. Just the fact is, it's not a closely held secret anymore. We know how to make atomic bombs.
Well, the fissionable material is obviously an important element.
Yeah.
And the Egyptians have had two little reactors running since very early on. Since 1954, they've had a very tiny 2 megawatt reactor, the ETRR-1, which runs on 10% enriched uranium. And another one, which came online in 1998, which is the ETRR-2, which was that first one was built by the Soviets. This one was built by the Soviet, and the Argentinians. And it runs on 19.75%.
Now, these percentages are way below the percentage of purity necessary to make an atomic bomb.
Yes, but let me just get to the point. They've also got a hot cell laboratory, which allows them to take the fuel rods and extract plutonium from them. They're used in these other reactors, particularly in the second reactor.
Like a breeder reactor.
Yes, exactly. And they have therefore have been producing since 1998, so the last, 14 years, they have been producing enough plutonium, they make 6 grams and some extra every year this way.
And it takes, about
1998, they could have produced enough for 14 plus bombs.
I was going to say, what does it take, about 10 kilograms, 20-some pounds?
6 kilograms is enough for, plutonium is enough for one bomb.
Interesting. And
well,
one other point.
We don't know the quality of that plutonium, unfortunately. So.
One other point that we should make, too, is plutonium used for peaceful nuclear purposes that often?
Well, They do run a lot of isotope sort of programs.
Yeah,
they
but not nuclear power, for example. Aren't all nuclear power plants based on uranium?
Yes, I think.
Yeah.
So I'm not a nuclear expert, but this is definitely an interesting.
In other words, if they're going for this, they're not that interested in medical research.
Yeah.
They're building bombs.
Yeah. So they are. Well, I would not draw that absolute conclusion. I would.
Okay.
A lot of people have written about this in the past. And not drawn that obvious conclusion, so I would hesitate to jump there. But I would say that they are definitely in a position to. I mean, certainly plutonium is a fissionable material that can be used to make nuclear weapons.
Yeah.
So and they have a lot of it if they haven't used it for other purposes. And no one has been able to truly. No one's really inspected their program very thoroughly. They've even had a couple of instances in 2004. They were reported for to the IAEA. Which was then run by Mohammed al-Baradei, who was the former IAEA chief, now one of the leaders of the opposition to Morsi, who is believed by many to have coddled the Iranian nuclear program, and he's an Egyptian lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
He issued this very vague report, not really criticizing them, for having done unreported experiments and for having traces of highly enriched uranium, which is exactly the sort of thing that was found in Iran,
mm-hmm.
which led to the conclusion that the AQ Khan from Pakistan had been helping them develop their nuclear weapons program.
Yes, so the Pakistani, the father of the Islamic bomb, as some call it.
Exactly.
More to come. So, stay with us. We'll be right back. 1-866-50-JIMBO, 1-866-505-4626. Professor Raymond Stock is our guest, and have a nice day. But that's the nature of the headlines. We'll be right back. Talking about the Egyptian leadership and the direction it may be pushing that country, and by virtue of, again, Egypt's size, pushing the entire region, with Middle Eastern expert Professor Raymond Stock. I had a guest on this program a couple of years or so back, and I asked him, after Pakistan, who would be the next Islamic nuclear power? He answered, France. Yes, it is kind of a sick joke, but maybe not so funny. And his point obviously was that the French, already a nuclear power, along with a fair chunk of Europe, is in the process of Islamization, if in fact there is such a term. I noticed a moment ago that among those lined up to help the Muslim Brotherhood would be the European Union. I mean, Europe, as we know it, will it survive the 21st century?
Well, before I address that question, one very quick point. 1961 was the year that the first reactor came online in Egypt. It began in 1954 construction.
Okay.
But your question, I think Europe is much further along than we are in terms of the Islamization process.
Yes, as a matter of fact, in terms of the percentage of births, in terms of the workforce increasingly being taken over. I mean, seriously, I don't think that's a stretch given the birth rate projections in much of Europe, and given where their workforce is coming from, the workforce required to fuel those still quite expansive social programs in Western Europe. I don't know that, as I said, Europe as we know it will still exist by the end of this century.
I don't think it will in the same way that we know Europe.
I don't think
America as we know it will remain America by the end of the century, but how will that be is another question.
I mean, yeah, but at least that's, I think, a little more arguable. The French, it seems, and much of Europe have gone past the tipping point. Now then, given all that we have talked about to this point, what should be the U.S. policy in your regard? Are we talking about some irreversible force here? I mean, there's no point in standing in front of the oncoming tide with a teaspoon, obviously, but clearly American foreign policy should be based on our best interests. What exactly would that be?
Well, it's very hard to say what to do now because we've already committed ourselves down this path in such a way that's very difficult to back out of it. The only thing we can do is sort of say no at this point to funding, to cooperation with these governments that we feel are Islamist. And we should recognize that all Islamist governments are the same, ultimately in their objectives, if not in their strategy.
What about that great divide that we were always taught about back in the days of the Iran-Iraq war? Sunni, Shia, hate each other, hate. I mean, and there are fundamentalists, obviously, on both sides of that divide and a few others. The Islamic world is, in fact, more splintered than Christianity, even. Does that not matter? I mean, when it comes to fundamental Islamic viewpoints, are the terms Sunni and Shia not as important as we were told?
They're very important, and on the street level, on the ground level, there's a lot of animosity in many places between them. But on the leadership level, and among the terrorist networks, there's a lot of cooperation. And one should not overestimate that chasm between them. Certainly it's real in some ways, but it's not by any means decisive in terms of who will play with whom, you know, in working against us. I mean, the leadership of Iran openly calls for cooperation with Sunni groups. They have worked together in Iraq. They possibly worked together and almost certainly worked together in 9/11. They worked together. I mean, at least the Iranians allowed transit for al-Qaeda members during the preparation for 9/11. They worked together in Afghanistan and other places.
The enemy of my enemy is my friend.
And look at Hamas and Hezbollah. They cooperate. Iran is one of the major funding sources for Hamas, and also was under Mubarak for the Muslim Brotherhood.
Yeah.
So in the later years of the Mubarak era, there was considerable evidence that the Iranians were cooperating with the MB.
Have these folks ever considered maybe just building up their societies, learning one or two lessons from the great Satan, which is to say that you wind up with a more prosperous and more stable population if, in fact, you allow the development of free market systems and some a genuine public participation in a democratic process? And there's the reason that you folks live in the armpit of the planet, and it's because of the very fact that you have denied a lot of these things. Has that ever occurred to these people, or are they more interested in marching to Jerusalem and the hell with their country? I mean, that party probably is at the core of why we don't understand these people.
You're so right, Jim, about this is a very important point, and very few people get this. We tend to look at folks as being like ourselves. I mean, it's a very normal human tendency to do that. We project onto other people our own traits. And we assume that these people want the same things we do, you know, material prosperity, a good life for their families, et cetera, et cetera.
A lot of these folks
have come. They don't even find that the same way when they have it.
A lot of them have come, by the way, to Western Europe, the United States and other places, presumably in search of that. That's why most immigrants have come to those countries.
Yes. And by the way, an awful lot of them come over to our country because they often want to get away from what they have to endure in their own country.
Exactly. And then how many of them, in fact, engage in either overt moves or acquiescence to allow the very tendencies they left behind to take root here?
Well, you have both kinds that come, and all kinds that come.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them are those who want to carry on the war against us within our own country, and some of them are people who want to get away from that war and don't care about the war, and the others who are against the war itself, and they want to be like, they want to be just normal, good, normal people as we would define them.
All right.
So you have all these different tendencies, and they exist also in those societies themselves.
Yeah. More to come. Stay with us. We're going to take a quick break and be right back. Welcome back to the Jim Bohannon Show as we talk with Professor Raymond Stock this evening. What caused you to get kicked out of Egypt?
Well, I wrote an article, as you mentioned earlier at the top of the program, criticizing the culture minister, Farouk Hosni, who was, he'd been minister for 22 years, I think, at that time, or so, or longer. And he was running for the head of UNESCO. And he was favored to win. But he'd made a lot of anti-Semitic and anti-Israeli statements over the years. He'd instituted a policy of no contact whatsoever between Egyptian cultural figures and Egyptian cultural institutions and any Israelis of any kind, even peace activists in it from Israel, and et cetera, et cetera. So he was a person I thought was really inappropriate to make head of UNESCO.
And by running, I assume he was running within the membership of the UN General Assembly?
No, within the membership of UNESCO, the delegations from the various countries are in UNESCO.
Okay.
They're members of UNESCO. Vote for the director general every so many years.
Yeah.
So he was up. It was a vacancy, and he was running, and he was favored to win in the election scheduled, you know, at the Paris headquarters of UNESCO in September 2009. That was when it was going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And my article appeared in late August, and this followed on an article that had been published by Claude Lanzmann, Bernard-Henri Lévy, and Elie Wiesel in Le Monde, these three very prominent Jewish intellectual figures, attacking Farouk Hosni's choice, or his nomination, you know, mm-hmm. to be head of UNESCO,
right.
His candidacy.
Anyway, suffice it to say, he took exception, what were you told to leave, or how did the process of ejection work?
Well, I was actually out of the country for a while. I left in August to start teaching at Drew, and I went back in December for the break.
Yeah.
And when I arrived at the airport, I had told them I was coming back.
Yeah.
Everything was fine. And when I arrived, they said, no, you can't come in. They held me overnight and deported me back the way I came through London, back to Newark.
Interesting. In the time that we have left, I must ask you a bit about the Syrian civil war and the extent to which this is directly related to anything that we've talked about tonight.
Well, it's very related in the sense that the Muslim Brotherhood is the probable winner of the Syrian civil war. And we're very much involved with arming and assisting in other ways the Syrian opposition.
I thought it was very difficult, just as it had been in Libya and in a number of other places, to pin down precisely who the Assad opposition is.
Well, I think...
Not true, huh?
I think it's very hard to really be sure, you know. Uh-huh. But I think that the trouble is we waited a very long time. We've let the time factor is very important. They waited a very long time mm-hmm. in all these countries, Libya, Syria, Egypt, to, you know, in terms of figuring out who's who. Well, we knew in Egypt that they wanted the Muslim Brotherhood, but I think that they didn't look at the other side, the other people at all. And now they see that they are going to wind up with an Islamist regime everywhere. And I think they probably like this because they think these people are going to play ball with them. They're not going to play ball. They're not going to be the way they hope they will be, at least as they are kidding themselves that they're going to be. And I really hope that's what it really will be a disappointment to them, and that they really haven't got some other ideas in their minds. You raised this issue yourself about what the actual beliefs of the president are and his people, the people around him.
Yeah. Well, suffice it to say that we'll pause briefly here and we'll speak off air again. A Middle Eastern expert, Professor Raymond Stock, our guest on the Jim Bohannon Show, and things could be better in that neck of the woods. I'm Jim Bohannon on the Dial Global Radio Networks. good to have you with us on the Jim Bohannon Show at 1-866-50-JIMBO, 1-866-505-4626. Online, you'll find us at jimbotalk.net. As we're going to be talking in this portion of the program about another one of those factors on the international stage, which increasingly get our attention, and for good reason. The Chinese have obviously been expanding in many ways. They have been expanding in terms of their economy, in terms of world influence. They are certainly far, far removed from the extremely insular nation that Mao Zedong led. And they have had more and more impact on the world at large. They are developing more and more of a blue water navy, that is to say, not just coastal defense. They recently got their first aircraft carrier, and, of course, their possession of intercontinental ballistic missiles and nuclear weapons is long a foregone conclusion. In particular, their relationship with this country is interesting. Some might call it that of the enabler with their booze. We, of course, are red ink junkies, and the Chinese are our enablers. They have largely financed a good chunk of our debt. We, in turn, of course, by buying all those Chinese goods, have been a major factor in fueling that Chinese economy. So it's an interesting relationship, to say the least, in which it can be argued that we need each other, and in many ways, especially economically, we do. But then again, we've got these tension points like Taiwan and North Korea. And as I say, it's worthy of the occasional discussion tonight. And we're going to be doing so with a policy expert, strategist, and lawyer with years of experience in government, an adjunct fellow of Pacific Forum CSIS, affiliated with the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He is Donald Gross, author of The China Fallacy, How the U.S. Can Benefit from China's Rise and Avoid Another Cold War. It's in paperback from Continuum Books. Good to have you with us.
Great to be here, Jim.
Amplify, if you would, on my opening remarks there about this complicated Sino-American relationship.
Well, you hit it. You hit most of the high points, especially on the economic side. There's a great deal of interdependence between the U.S. and China. Treasury Secretary Geithner, not long ago, made the statement that China and the U.S. have a great deal invested in each other's success. I think that's a very important point, just from the standpoint of the United States. China's our largest growth market in the world for U.S. goods and services. It's third largest export market that we have. It's actually the largest export market for U.S. agricultural products. And over the coming years, there'll be not just U.S. investment flowing into China, not just outgoing flow of U.S. goods and services, because China is in many respects still a developing country and has tremendous material needs, but there'll also be, most people think, in 2015, China will become a net exporter of capital. That is to say, there'll be more Chinese capital moving overseas than it's coming in to the country, and the U.S. stands to be a major beneficiary of that in the coming years. Already this year, we're on track to receive about $8 billion in Chinese investment. And then, of course, that translates into U.S. jobs and economic development. So it is, as you said, a very close, interdependent relationship on the economic side.
Of course, countries do not live by economics alone, and there are other factors here. Obviously, I can recall, for example, a few years ago when there was some flare-up regarding China and Taiwan, the breakaway Chinese province, which has been since the fall of Chiang Kai-shek back in the late 40s, has been effectively an independent nation, never, of course, acknowledged as such by the Chinese officially, but de facto it is and has been. And at that point, there was some comment made by some Chinese general. It was roughly along the lines of whether or not the U.S. would really be willing to back Taiwan to the point of having a missile lobbed into Los Angeles. It was rather intemperate language. And I'm wondering if these days, if we had a similar dust-up, if the warning shot across our bow would not be fired by a Chinese general, but maybe by the Chinese finance ministry, who would simply call Tim Geithner and simply say that if, you want us to keep bailing you out of your profligate spending ways, back off on Taiwan. Isn't that the main pressure point that we face now?
Well, let me just take that into two parts.
Okay.
The situation in Taiwan and the situation with U.S. debt and how much leverage that might give the Chinese. Since 2008, when President Ma of Taiwan was elected, we've seen a real reduction in tensions between Taiwan and China. They have reached an economic cooperation agreement.
So they have regular airline flights?
That's exactly right. They ramped up considerably the regular flights between Taiwan and the mainland. They've cut tariff and non-tariff barriers between the two countries. There's a great deal of Taiwanese investment in China and increasingly Chinese investment in Taiwan. That's all to the good. And that on the economic side, we all know that greater prosperity, greater just business relationships between two countries have an ameliorating effect and improves relations on a general level. But then on the military side in Taiwan, still, Taiwan is faced by between 1,000 and 1,200 short-range missiles, according to the Pentagon's latest estimates, not to mention the fact that there are Chinese Air Force installations, Chinese ships in the neighborhood. China occasionally practices landings in Taiwan as a threatening way. Going back to what you said earlier about the 1995-96 period, China launched some missiles which they said were quote-unquote tests in the vicinity of Taiwan, and we sent two aircraft carrier battle groups, which effectively forced them to back off. So on Taiwan, the good news is that relations are much, much better than they were under the previous president, largely due to the cooperative economic policies of President Ma, who was reelected early in 2012. So it's something that the majority of Taiwanese people approve. But then there is this underlying tension because of the significant military threat that China poses to Taiwan. And in the case of a new president who came in, you remember that the big issue for Taiwan is whether they can get juridical, legal independence, formal independence as a country from China. And then that's a real red line for the Chinese.
They've always been willing to maintain the hypocrisy of you're still a part of China, but we just don't have a lot of say-so. But if in fact they tried to make this official and legal, that, I guess, that has not changed. The Chinese policy at that point is no way, Jose. They would not. At that point, military action might, I don't know if it would be likely, but possible, certainly.
Right, and that's why the United States, the State Department, and U.S. diplomats have, during a period when the DPP, the party in Taiwan that was pushing for independence as a country, was seeming to go too far. The U.S. actually pushed them back to prevent the U.S. from being drawn into a new war between Taiwan and China. But I want to hit that second point you made about debt. Fact is that I think it was Fareed Zakaria who commented in one of his books that Chinese holdings of U.S. Of U.S. securities, of U.S. debt, don't really give them significant leverage, and one of the last things they would want to do is to threaten to start pulling out their investment because it would cause a drastic drop in the value of those securities. They would be big losers economically.
Economically.
And
it's the price that the Politburo in Beijing might be willing to pay if they had to.
Well, I don't think so, with all due respect. The reason is that that Chinese people and who are increasingly active, as you know, on the Internet and think tanks, have often criticized the Chinese government for not getting enough from the investments in the Chinese sovereign wealth funds. Actually, the Chinese government is criticized by large constituencies in China if it loses money in overseas investments. And these Chinese sovereign wealth funds are government money. So there is real political sensitivity there, that the government in itself in China has a limiting factor, a domestic constituency. So
in the land of perhaps the purest Marxist in recent memory, Mao Zedong, we've reached the point now where business considerations can drive foreign policy.
Economic considerations, certainly.
Interesting.
There's no doubt about it.
Well, you could power Beijing just off of Mao spinning in his grave over that one. As we go to the break here, I'm curious about one thing. I noticed the situation in Hong Kong, which for years, of course, was British property and an irritant in the side of China, even, of course, as they were a source of some considerable hard currency. And then, of course, came the transfer of power with some guarantees of Hong Kong sovereignty. I know we talked with a democracy activist in Hong Kong at one point on this program, and I haven't spoken with her since, so I'm not sure the extent to which that has become an empty facade, mm-hmm. or whether or not Hong Kong still maintains a fair level of actual independence. Mm-hmm. But I'm wondering if Taiwan could wind up in a similar state, that is to say, closer to China, officially a part of China, but with a certain amount of autonomy. Are we at all headed in that direction?
Of course, it'll be up to the Taiwanese people. The Chinese had a formula, a diplomatic formula, which they've thrown around for several years, which has proved to be unacceptable to Taiwan, which is one country, two systems. They're on the surface, they're offering autonomy, political autonomy, the preservation of the Taiwanese democratic system. But the level of skepticism in Taiwan is certainly high. I think the most interesting thing about, you mentioned Hong Kong and Taiwan, is that they're both thriving democracies. Taiwan, especially, is a homegrown Chinese democracy. As you mentioned earlier, Chiang Kai-shek was a dictator. In the early years of his rule, they massacred many native Taiwanese people. It was a true dictatorship on par with other dictatorships we've seen around the world. And yet, Taiwan emerged. So that if there's a move in the future, in the coming years, for political reform in China, it's quite possible that Chinese people will look to Taiwan as a model and be inspired. They already, in this last re-election campaign in January, on the internet, they were very, many, many millions of Chinese people were very closely watching Taiwanese election, and it was instructive because they learned about it. So
I'm just curious to the extent to which Hong Kong remains autonomous. I mean, effectively.
I think it's quite autonomous effectively in a political sense. It's integrated very closely with the Chinese mainland economy. The Chinese people in Hong Kong want that. Taiwan serves as a hub for global capital. Remember, it has had it's a world-class financial market, and it acts in that role with respect to the mainland Chinese economy. But from a political standpoint, you often see whenever there seems to be an infringement of Hong Kong's political autonomy or the rights that Hong Kong citizens have, you see demonstrations in the streets, you see lawyers in Hong Kong are very active in countering what they see as infringements of rights from the mainland Chinese government. I think that my observation is that Chinese government is respectful of that.
No, they're not. They don't as a cancer. We've got to suppress these Hong Kong types out there. They're causing dissent in the mainland.
It's like a pain in the neck that they're willing to live with as long as Hong Kong is serving this very valuable economic role.
All right. More to come. Stay with us as we talk with Donald Gross. He's the author of The China Fallacy in paperback from Continuum. China is going to be a major part of our future, folks. It's a major part of our present, too. And that's not going to change, except maybe to increasingly grow. More to come. We'll be back. Good to have you with us on the Jim Bohannon Show at 1-866-50-JIMBO as we talk with Donald Gross, former State Department and White House official, and the author of The China Fallacy, which, by the way, is in paperback from Bloomsbury. Now, in The China Fallacy, you argue against the notion of containment of China, which our past two presidents engaged in, although, in fact, have not both presidents and a number of those before them, going back to Richard Nixon, engaged in a considerable amount of engagement as well as containment.
Right. The big change in U.S. policy occurred in February 1972, as you and many of your listeners will recall, when President Nixon, with the advice of Secretary of State Kissinger, did what was then called the opening to China. Nixon went to China, Kissinger went before him, to reach a basis for understanding with the government of Mao, Chairman Mao, as you mentioned earlier. And since 1972, for 30 or for more years, we've had a bipartisan tradition in the United States, or let's say a policy with significant bipartisan support, of improving relations with China, building areas for cooperation. Initially, back in the 1970s, it helped us considerably strategically against the Soviet Union.
There was a time when we actually had some rather classified listening posts in China. The level of cooperation between the Chinese and the Americans regarding the Soviet Union was pretty remarkable.
That's right, and I think that what drove that was Mao's realization that the Soviet Union could actually was thinking about a preemptive nuclear strike on China at that time. So there was a real chance of a nuclear war breaking out, which is what prompted Mao to welcome the Americans and the grounds for cooperation. But going back to what you were saying earlier, I would say that during the Bush administration, we began what was called the strategic hedging policy toward China, major buildup of U.S. forces in the Pacific, specifically on the island of Guam, and also in other in other places in the region. That policy was significantly accelerated by the Obama administration about a year ago in October, November of last year, when the president announced what was called the strategic pivot policy. The strategic pivot is a pretty opaque term. What was meant by it was that as we wind down our wars in the Middle East, still happen to be going on, of course, in Afghanistan, but as our troops and our military forces are less needed in the Middle East, we can shift those forces to the Asia Pacific to counter a rising China. So in my view, and view of many others as well, we've been pursuing, especially in the last year or so, an effective containment policy, which is also described as a policy to carry out the strategic encirclement of China. A few examples of that are we're moving troops to northern Australia. We're looking for bases in the Far East, especially Southeast Asia. Secretary of Defense Panetta was in Vietnam during June and was looking to reopen for U.S. forces the Camran Bay facility, which we haven't had forces in Vietnam, of course, since
the Beautiful place, by the way, Camran Bay.
Is that right?
Oh,
since the Vietnam War.
Yeah.
So we're pursuing this strategy, and I think it's one of the arguments that I make in the book. It's very much against our interests because it's based on the fallacy, going to the title of the book, that we're going to face an inevitable war with China, and therefore we have to prepare for it. In fact, that amounts in the way I see it to a self-fulfilling prophecy. And it's especially ironic, as you know, just in the last day or two, the National Intelligence Council, so-called NIC, has come out with its Global Trends 2030 report. And in that report, they point out that the period of U.S. primacy or what they call unipolarity, where the U.S. is the dominant only superpower, is rapidly coming to an end.
Although I don't know that's necessarily something that we should embrace. I mean, whether or not that's a fact doesn't mean that we should not at least try to slow the trend. The idea of being the top dog, I think, is very beneficial to us in many ways.
The report says that we will still be the top dog in 2030.
Good.
It's not a case of another power replacing the United States. On the contrary, it simply lays out the fact that other powers, not just China, India, Brazil, and possibly Russia again, will emerge power centers around the world.
Yeah, we have to pause briefly because the computer is going to cut us off if we don't, and we'll be back with more right after these messages. Back to the Jim Bohannon Show at 1-866-50-JIMBO, 1-866-505-4626. We're talking about China and its relationship with the U.S., and it ain't going away, guarantee you that. We will have a continuing relationship with China for the foreseeable future within the lifetime of people who are listening to this program tonight. Kenneth calls in from Ozark, Alabama, for Donald Gross, author of The China Fallacy. Hi, Kenneth.
Yes, Jimbo. Nice talking to you.
Yes, sir.
I'm wondering, with China's stepchild, North Korea, acting out as it did just a few days ago.
The missile.
With their missile, would they allow them to draw them into a a war. I mean, something's going to have to be done, you know, there. But, you know, we're always afraid of China stepping back in and protecting their little sibling there. I'm just wondering. I'm sure that's caused as much tension right now as ever's been, you know.
Well, that's a good point that you bring up, Kenneth, and we'll discuss that. In fact, you anticipated my very next question. Talk about a complicated relationship between China and the U.S. How about the relationship between China and North Korea? For one thing, I'm sure that there are more than a few people in Beijing who are not thrilled with the world's first hereditary communist monarchy.
You're exactly right, Jim, and that's a very good question also. That the good news on the North Korean rocket launch is that China has stepped up and made a strong statement condemning it, because, as you were suggesting, Chinese are very skeptical about the North Korean leadership. They want stability on the Korean Peninsula, but they certainly don't like what the current regime is doing. They're condemning the provocation that occurred.
Well, nothing would go further towards stability on that peninsula and making sure that the problems in North Korea don't keep spilling over into Manchuria in the form of refugees, than for unification under the South, just as the two Germanys were unified under West Germany. Is that prospect so daunting to the Chinese that they couldn't bear to have a unified Korea along the Yalu River?
It's a very good point. And the reason that the Chinese take the position they do on North Korea, where they're sometimes supportive and sometimes critical, is that have to remember, strategically, North Korea is what's called a buffer zone for China. There are a lot of American forces in South Korea, as we all know. There's a very strong alliance relationship between the United States and South Korea. In the event of a military conflict, let's say over Taiwan, of the kind that you were talking about earlier, North Korea is viewed as a buffer zone, as a place where a million North Korean troops are standing between U.S. forces in the south and the Chinese border. As long as there's significant military competition between the United States and China, my view is that China will try to preserve the status quo on the peninsula and will not favor unification. On the other hand, if in the future there's a significant improvement in U.S.-China relations, and China no longer perceives a major military threat from the United States, my view is that China would acquiesce in a unification of the Korean Peninsula, because they would no longer see a unified Korea as part of a U.S. encirclement strategy. And that's why my final point would be, our increased military pressure on North Korea, on China, especially over the last year, actually undercuts our efforts to get North Korea to do what we want, to ratchet down its nuclear and missile programs. We know that China holds the cards, the Trump cards.
China can bring down
North
regime
Korea
in 3 weeks if
exactly.
It chose to.
That's right, and one of the reasons is all the oil and a lot of the material goods that North Korea needs to survive come from China.
Yes.
But they don't want to do it because they're worried that then the Korean Peninsula will become an avenue of invasion into China. It might sound paranoid, but remember that the Chinese have gone to war in the last century, mainly in a case where they felt encircled by other foreign powers.
Here's Bob in Gainesville, Georgia, to speak with Donald Gross. Good evening. Welcome to the program, Bob.
Thank you.
Yes.
I wanted to ask, what's your opinion of if the Chinese have tipped their hand regarding to their policy or developing policy regarding the Muslim growing worldwide Muslim influence or approaching hegemony?
Interesting thought, because the Chinese, a lot of people don't realize, the Chinese have had some problems with Islamists in their Western provinces.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And since 2001, after the attacks in New York, 9/11, Chinese government made a critical decision to cooperate with the United States in the war on terror. We don't recall that as much now as we did at the time, but there was a debate we've heard in the Chinese leadership about how to respond to the attacks from terrorists, and the Chinese government decided on through intelligence cooperation and through other efforts to support the United States in countering terrorism in the Middle East. Again, as Jim, you were saying, it's partly out of self-interest because they're very concerned about Muslim separatist influence and activities in the western part of the country. But they have been helpful to the United States over the decade.
Stay with us. More to come on the Jim Bohannon Show. We'll examine more about China and also about a concept known as playing by the rules. When they wanted to become one of the big boys and join the big boys club, how well they have learned the basic lessons of membership. Donald Gross, our guest, his book, The China Fallacy. It is in paperback from Bloomsbury. We'll be right back. Bohannon Show at 1-866-50-JIMBO, 1-866-505-4626. Donald Gross, our guest, a man who has written extensively and also been a practitioner in the government, former in the White House and the State Department, a man who knows this section of the woods, as it were, and offers some interesting thoughts regarding our dealings with China. To Lucy, who is in Charleston, South Carolina tonight. Hi, Lucy.
Hi, Jim. How are you?
I'm well, thank you, ma'am.
I have a question for your guest.
Sure.
Does he envision the Chinese government falling or any situation in which there's an arrest in China? And can he see that regime coming down? And I'll take his answer off air.
All right,
Thank
Lucy.
You.
Yeah, bet. Thank you for your call. Certainly, of course, you don't have to worry, obviously, about the Chinese government losing in the Shanghai primary. But on the other hand, they do have a lot of internal pressures and population, of movement to the cities and the like. I mean, they got problems, right?
That's right, Jim. The new president of China, Xi Jinping, is more aware of that than anyone. There's a lot of pressure from the middle class, from liberal intellectuals in China for political reform. There's a lot of pressure for economic reform. The reform impulse has been bottled up under the previous presidency of Hu Jintao. And even in the last 3 weeks, as President-to-be Xi Jinping has embarked on a three-week tour of China, he's made it clear that he's very likely, we don't know for sure, but he's very likely to be a reform-minded president, and that's very good news for the United States. He went down to Shenzhen, which is where former Chinese leader Deng Xiaoping conducted a tour in 1992 to revive economic reform in China after the 1989 Tiananmen crisis. He's put into place a new anti-corruption drive. He's talked to the Chinese people about the Chinese dream. We always talk about the American dream, but he's tried to inspire the Chinese people with the notion of the Chinese dream and the notion of the renewal of the Chinese nation, that it could become a prosperous country once again. And so in the area of political reform, and going to even the question that your caller had, there's a recognition that unless there's significant reform by the Communist Party, by the leadership of China, then in fact the Chinese government could fall, the Communist Party could fall. So they have a very strong interest in bringing about reform. And I believe that this creates a significant window of opportunity for the United States. President Obama going into his second term, not worrying, looking over his shoulder constantly about a re-election campaign, has a real chance to build a relationship with the new president of China, minimize some of the conflicts and tensions we have on the trade side, trying to tear down some of the significant tariff and non-tariff barriers that still impede relations between the two countries and that sort of thing. So,
you know, it's interesting to note back to the fall of the evil empire in which Mikhail Gorbachev tried in the Soviet Union to rescue Marxist economics by liberalizing politically, and of course the whole thing fell like a house of cards. Looking at it from an exactly opposite approach, that is to say, liberalizing economically but maintaining still a very authoritarian government. That model, so far, seems to be working pretty well in China and also Vietnam, for that matter, although there has been some democratic liberalization in Vietnam, but not enough to really amount to much. But the economic liberalization, there are Vietnamese millionaires just like there are Chinese millionaires, and I don't think either Ho Chi Minh nor Mao Zedong would be thrilled about it. But that, in other words, that model seems to have worked, and I'm not sure exactly why. I've long thought that the Chinese are very interested in being a big player on the world scene, and that in the 21st century, I wasn't sure if it is still a viable model to be a dictatorial world power. You can be a dictatorial backwater, maybe, in some little doofus country, but at the level of the Chinese, I've wondered if in the next decade or so they will not face the prospect of having to choose between maintaining that firm authoritarian rule or being a big player, just because their people have to be in touch with the rest of the world over the internet, free flow of information, and so on and so forth. Are they going to be forced to liberalize politically against their will?
I believe that there will be significant political liberalization in China, because there are significant pressures coming from the middle class and key factions in China against the cronyism and corruption of the Communist Party. So what that means is that to survive, the Chinese government has to reform. Right now, just to clarify a bit, there is something that observers call inter-party democracy in China. Within the Chinese party, the Chinese Communist Party, yeah. There are two major factions. There's a significant amount of horse trading and bargaining that goes on between the two. It's not what we would call, of course, an electoral democratic system, but there is there are the seeds, and more than the seeds, there are democratic practices that go on within the party.
What are these two factions? What do they represent? The old and the new, reform and stay the way we are? Or how would you describe them?
One faction is considered aligned with, focused heavily on economic modernization. It's particularly filled with so-called princelings, privileged members of the Chinese society whose parents were major political players during the period of Mao. Their heavy focus is on economic modernization. The other faction have more of a base in the party networks, and they have focused more on social reform in China, addressing social inequalities which exist. We got to recall that in 2011, there were something like 180,000 so-called mass incidents of social unrest in China. That means demonstrations, actions against local authorities and villages. Most often those were about environmental issues or big companies coming in, buying off the local political leaders, expropriating land from peasants and village people, and then that has called forth a significant reaction.
Are we talking about sign waving here or actual physical confrontations?
Oh, no, there have been actual physical confrontations. Mm-hmm. We don't hear much about deaths. I think that's probably limited, but but there are clearly cases of large demonstrations and then significant police presence moving in to protect local authorities against the environmental leaders, especially the local leaders that have pressed their demands. So there is a great deal of unrest in China. Of course, it's a big country. It hasn't brought down the government, but these pressures are mounting, and it's something that the new president, the new leadership in China has to address. And I believe the signs that we've seen in the last few weeks, after all, it's only been a few weeks since the new leadership has been announced, indicate that it's likely that there will at least be significant economic reform.
Okay.
We'll have to see.
More to come. Stay with us. We talk with Donald Gross, author of The China Fallacy, in paperback from Bloomsbury. We'll be back. Good to have you with us on The Bohannon Show at 1-866-50-JIMBO with Donald Gross, author of The China Fallacy and paperback from Bloomsbury. Looking at the inclusion of China, of course, for years very insular, very removed from the world stage, and then they decided they were going to come forth and oh, they might join the big nations and the International Monetary Fund and a host of other things. And the rules were explained to them. You want to be in the big boys' club. This is how we play the game. And then they proceeded to get into all kinds of theft of intellectual property, or at least looking the other way while the intellectual property was stolen, currency manipulation, domestic human rights abuses, tolerating, coddling, even, in fact, propping up the regime in North Korea, all the while doing a lot of things that, in other words, indicated they weren't the least bit interested in obeying the damn rules. Doesn't that have to change at some point? Doesn't somebody have to call them on this?
There are a lot of issues that you put together there.
Yeah,
I remember when Bob Zelik, the former Deputy Secretary of State, said that China's role from the standpoint of the United States should be what he called a responsible stakeholder, going to what you were saying earlier, playing an important role as a major power in upholding the international system and the international organizations, the International Monetary Fund. On the economic side, let me just take a couple of those issues. In terms of RMB, the Chinese currency, which was undervalued, of course, that was a big issue in the presidential campaign. The fact is there that Chinese currency has considerably risen. It's now, according to the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, this past July, only moderately undervalued. That is to say, there's not a significant difference between the value that it should have, in our view, according to the market, and the value that it has. Now, we have to keep pressuring the Chinese to let the RMB rise to its acceptable market level.
Mm-hmm.
That's one thing. On the with respect to the infringement of intellectual property, former Secretary of Commerce Bryson met with the Chinese and reached agreement at the end of 2011 for a new nationwide system to enforce intellectual property rules, the rights of foreign companies that hold patents and copyrights that were being pirated. The central government is doing the right thing. The problem there is
how vigorously.
I believe our estimate is from the U.S. Trade Rep that they are. That the central government is truly committed, honestly, to strengthening IPR rules because it's in their self-interest. If China wants to wants to increase rapidly its overseas investment, use technologies of its own around the world, it needs that protection, too. So it's very much in China's interest to do that.
Here's a call from Nelson in Reading, Pennsylvania. Hello, Nelson, and welcome to the Jim Bohannon Show.
Hello, Jim. I know it's getting late, so I'll make this really quick.
Okay.
Years ago, a decade or more, my former father-in-law was a purchasing director for a number of companies, a company, spent a lot of time traveling to India, Japan, and China.
Mm-hmm.
In a conversation, he noted that the Chinese they had a big picture and they had a lot of patience.
Yeah.
But he also noted that in China at the time, late 90s, that the emerging economic and entrepreneurial people were mostly under the age of 30 and 35.
Yeah. Okay.
And I was wondering if that emergence has changed the fundamental behavior.
Very, very good. What about the new generation? Are they changing things?
I think your caller is exactly right. The new generation, younger generation, many of whom were educated overseas, including many in the United States,
mm-hmm.
are very energetic, are very competitive, and we've got to remember, within China, in business and companies, it's extremely competitive.
Right.
They are at the vanguard, and I think that your caller has it right.
Very, very good. Well, we're going to have to wrap on that note with thanks again to Donald Gross. Again, the book, The China Fallacy, is in paperback from Bloomsbury. I'm Jim Bohannon on the Dial Global Radio Networks. goodness gracious sakes alive. How are you folks doing tonight? You've got the Jim Bohannon Show right here. I would say you should probably take two aspirin and call us in the morning. If the symptoms persist, then you just have to keep listening. I guess that's pretty much all you can do. This coming evening, the Bohannon Show is going to offer our annual year-in-review program. We'll be talking to Burson Marsteller, professional Paul Rodriguez, one of the best investigative journalists in the nation's capital, blogger Marty Davis from the chickaboomer.com website, and also David Bowes from the Cato Institute. We'll look at the events of 2012 and ahead to 2013 on the forthcoming Bohannon program. And thanks very much to our guests earlier in this program tonight, Raymond Stock, and look at the Egyptian leadership under Mohamed Morsi, increasingly moving in the direction of a dictatorial Islamist regime, which Professor Stock says should not have surprised anybody, especially our professionals in the State Department. And in the past hour, another area of concern in this world of ours, China. And we talked with Donald Gross, who's the author of the book, The China Fallacy, in paperback from Bloomsbury, and subtitled How the U.S. Can Benefit from China's Rise and Avoid Another Cold War. So, there are problems in this old world of ours. We wish that that was not the case, but it is, and wishing will only carry you so far. So, you do the best you can. Here's a shocker. Wine consumption in France is now down to about 15 gallons a year, which is about a third of what it was half a century ago. I'm not sure what the wine consumption is in this country, but I can guarantee you that I'm not doing my part. Somebody's drinking a lot of wine to make it for what I don't. First, we blow up the Kremlin, then we burn Moscow to the ground. That, we now find out, was Napoleon's plan when he invaded Russia two centuries ago. It's all in code in a letter signed by Napoleon, something that he rarely did, by the way, which may be why the letter fetched $244,000 at auction near Paris, 10 times what was expected. Yeah, we all know that lobsters fight. That's why they get rubber bands on their claws at the supermarket. But now, New Hampshire researchers have discovered for the first time that lobsters do more than fight. They engage in lobster cannibalism, and without even the benefit of melted butter. Remember the episode of The Simpsons when the devil orders God to make him coffee? Well, that upset a few folks here. But not like in Turkey, where the TV broadcasting regulator who let that episode on Turkish TV has been fined $30,000. The special at the new Denny's restaurant in Las Vegas, a wedding right after a big Elvis helping of bacon, peanut butter, and bananas. That's right. At Denny's, you can get married. Won't the kids and grandkids be proud someday? Oh, with a bacon vodka chaser, by the way. I didn't make that up. A bacon vodka chaser. The reception, I hope, features bicarbonate of soda. And from Salisbury, North Carolina, Spider-Man, or somebody wearing the mask, has held up a Chinese restaurant. Police responded, but their dogs can only track his trail so far. You don't suppose? No. Couldn't possibly be. We've got JimboTalk.net as a little diversion for you, wherein you will find things like our poll. We asked you last week what you like most about the holiday. 55% of you picked family and friends. 3% of you picked gift-giving and receiving. I was amazed. And this week's poll is the fiscal cliff. What do you think is going to happen? Your choices are there will be a comprehensive deal struck. We'll ask those people next week where they stand on the tooth fairy. Or a short-term deal will be struck with details to be worked out by the new Congress. Or no deal by the deadline, but a retroactive deal will be reached by March 31st, the end of the first quarter of the new year. Or no deal at all, higher taxes, massive budget cuts all the way around, and we all get into sackcloth and ashes. Just go to JimboTalk.net. You can click on our poll, okay? Also, a website that you might want to look at besides JimboTalk.net is DialGlobalSports.com. All kinds of great stuff from some big names out there. How does Tom Brady or Boomer Esiason grab you? Jim Gray, James Lofton, Terry Donahue, Larry Fitzgerald, Tony Boselli, and many others. They've got a schedule of our sporting events that are covered over many of these same Dial Global stations. For example, this coming evening, Cincinnati against Philadelphia in Thursday Night Football, the Sunday NFL doubleheader, tripleheader, actually, Indianapolis against Houston. That's the first game, 12:30, 3:45, Carolina and San Diego, 7:30 game, the 49ers against the New England Patriots, and Monday night's football game, the Jets and the Tennessee Titans. So all stuff that is certainly worthy of your consideration, I would dare say. And some friends of mine in Geneva, New York, members of the Geneva High School class of 1962, some ladies decided to make a calendar for 2013 to benefit breast cancer research and survivors. And it's along the lines of the British comedy Calendar Girls. They show some skin, not a ton, but a little bit of skin. And you can get your calendar, which costs $15 plus $5 shipping and handling, at ghs_calendar@hotmail.com. That's as in Geneva High School. This is Geneva, New York. ghs_calendar@hotmail.com. It's a cute calendar. They did a good job on that. More to come. When we come back, we're going to be talking a little bit about where we stand in terms of the economy and where you stand in terms of your economy in dealing with all the expenses of the holiday season. Former Oklahoma Governor Frank Keating, now the CEO of the American Bankers Association, will join us. We'll be right back. Holiday shopping time is very much here. And in fact, we've heard reports that shopping is up in many sectors, especially online shopping. And as a matter of fact, now the National Retail Federation has been forecasting holiday sales to total about $586.1 billion this year, which would be a 4.1% increase from last year. We're told that 40% of all shoppers started shopping before Halloween, believe it or not. Another 10% will hit the stores during this Thanksgiving week, and 46% in all will be shopping online. The remaining 4% will wait until the last 2 weeks of December, I suppose. Let's talk a bit about the pitfalls of all of this, because, yeah, it's going to help the economy, but what about your economy? We're going to be talking with Frank Keating, former governor of Oklahoma, and now the CEO of the American Bankers Association. Are we talking about another major expansion of debt? And I don't mean the federal debt.
Well, Jim, that's the problem. And I don't want to be the Grinch that steals Christmas. But I think it's really important to emphasize that, yes, it's true, Cyber Monday, big time, a third increase in purchases. Yes, Black Friday, more people were in stores. They didn't spend quite as much as they did last year, but more people in the stores. That's good in the sense that all of us are feeling better about our economy and ourselves. But realize also that the good news of paying down mortgage debt, the good news of paying down personal debt, could be eclipsed if we're not careful by a dark cloud in January where we're stuck with a great big Christmas bill that we simply gasp when we look at it. So it's really important to be prudent, careful, think selfishly, if you will. You got to pay this back. So if you're going to buy gifts for people, and all of us do, make sure that those are people you really want to give gifts to. Don't spend money foolishly or unnecessarily. And establish a budget for yourself and stick to it. Whether you're paying in cash or credit card, stick to your budget so that you're not in a situation where, in effect, you fall off the wagon in January, you have a holiday hangover in January and find that you're really in debt in January and you didn't mean to be.
Yeah, now this is a making of a budget here that's tough for a lot of people. It's just a shame that we don't have big printing presses and vats of green ink like Uncle Sam has over on 14th Street in Washington. We could just forget all about that debt and just keep racking up the total without any worries or cares. But since we do have to pay it back, I'm wondering about the use of credit at all. I know that many people will scoff at the very notion, you not use credit in the holidays? How else am I going to buy all of this stuff? And yet, I guess that's something to keep in mind, isn't it? Paying cash?
Well, no, that's absolutely right. In my own case, and I don't think I'm any different than any other person out there, I know I spend less if I use cash. But again, I hate to flash around a bunch of $20 bills. I'm concerned about that. So I'll use credit cards, but I keep a receipt, and I put those credit cards in my desk that I can look at them. I mean, excuse me, those credit card receipts, and then I know exactly what it is that I'm going to have to pay. So next month, when the Visa or MasterCard or Discover bill comes, American Express bill comes, I know that I'm going to be able to pay it. The one thing you don't want to do is get in a situation you're spending months paying off Christmas debt, because obviously the interest rate's going to be prohibitively high to pay it back, and also you're going to have a lot of disquiet. There are going to be some sleepless nights. So what I know when my wife and I were first married, we don't do it as much today. We would limit the number of people we give gifts to. If we're going to visit somebody, yes, we take a gift. And sometimes we'll companion that gift that we purchase at a store with cookies that we made, or with, for example, some item that we made out of paper mache or whatever, a Christmas ornament that's personalized to the person who we're visiting. I mean, those kinds of things are not terribly expensive, but they really are exciting when you sit down with friends and show them something that you have personalized for them. It also saves you money, and you don't tell your friends that, of course.
Now, in terms of shopping, a lot of us are very rushed and stressed in the holiday season, but I guess to the extent that you can avoid that, you should be planning a comparison, shopping, and not just dash out and just grab stuff right and left.
Well, that's absolutely right, Jim. When I was younger and my wife and I were newlyweds, we didn't have the opportunity to get online and determine what is out there, where is it, how much is it, and should I buy it. Today you have an opportunity to do a lot of advanced planning. You can get online, you can find out what the price of a particular object or item is, you can determine whether or not you can afford it, you can look at credit terms, if any. All those things are available to shoppers today. Advanced planning is possible. If you want to save on gasoline, avoid the crowds, you want to buy something online, then you want to make sure you're using a web address that you know. I mean, I buy things, for example, on Amazon or eBay that I can trust because I know the site and I know they have a system in that site to say whether the person you're dealing with has a rating of 100% or 0%. So I think it's just important to be prudent, budget, limit your spending. Realize that if you're paying down your household debt, which is very good, and we all need to do that, it doesn't help in January to find out that you're back up to your eyeballs in debt again because of Christmas spending that you didn't have to do.
Now, I understand that if you find a spectacular sale on something that you've been wanting, that this can throw you off course occasionally and that you've got to avoid traps.
Well, that's right. The you know, my grandfather was in the retail business, and he used to say, if you put more than 10 or 12 things on a table, people will shut down. It's really hard for them to decide, what do I buy if I see so many things? Well, apparently our genes are a little bit different today because people walk into stores and go crazy. And they say, oh, gee, I need that. Well, do they really? Or, oh, gosh, I need that. Well, do you really? I would prioritize what you do need and purchase that. Put a down payment, if you will, on something that you and your family think is important. You don't have to buy it all at once. You can say, you know, what we're going to do over the next 90 days is save money to buy X. Then we're going to get it. We'll probably have a better price after the Christmas holidays. We're going to save money. I know when I was a little boy, my dad insisted that I open a Christmas club account, that I would go to the bank and I'd put in $5 a week or $5 a month, as the case may be, so I'd have an account to buy presents at Christmas. Well, today a lot of big retailers do layaway, and if there are especially expensive products that you want to buy, appliances and the like, then you can pay down on that over the course of a number of months so that when you present it to your spouse or your spouse presents some wonderful item to you, you know it's virtually paid for, which is a huge, huge relief.
As long as I'm talking with the CEO of the American Bankers Association, I should probably ask you about one thing that has happened in recent years. We went from that period when anybody could get a loan for anything to a period when it was almost impossible to get a loan. Have we stopped gyrating between extremes now? What's the standard these days in terms of people with reasonable credit going and asking for a loan?
I think that banks out there, whether you're on the East Coast, the West Coast, or in the middle of the country, as where I'm from, they want to make loans, but they want to make credit-worthy loans. They want to make sure they get paid back. And I think the hysteria and the exuberance of the mid-2000s, that kind of lending is gone. There's just simply no way, no asset, no income, no ability to repay loans will be made, which means what? The smartest, best thing to do to make sure you have good credit is to have good credit. You know, pay your bills, don't spend more than you can afford, be very prudent and careful, and that way you'll always have an opportunity for access to credit. But the old days of the go-go loans, those just are gone. The regulators won't let the banks make those loans, and obviously prudent banks, prudent lenders won't make them because they want to make sure they're paid back.
Looking at the fiscal cliff, since you're not only the CEO of the American Bankers Association, but a former elected official as well, how serious is that going to be? Do you think, in fact, we will jump off and go cliff diving, or will some kind of accommodation be reached?
Well, obviously, the president has to be the person to bring everybody together, shut the doors, turn out the lights, draw the curtains, and say, we're not leaving here until we resolve this. And right now, who knows? I think the Republicans, and I don't disagree with them, are the view, let's don't lower or raise rates per se. Let's get rid of a lot of the exemptions, if not all of them, deductions and credits for the upper income. And I think most people would agree, even Republicans, and I'm a Republican, would agree that that's probably prudent and is politically doable. Democrats, on the other hand, have to realize what drives this debt. And remember, from George Washington to the start of George W. Bush, we increased the debt from zero to $5 trillion. In 8 years under George W. Bush, it doubled to 10, and President Obama's added another six. So we're on an unsustainable path. I was on the Rivlin-Domenici deficit panel. When you look at these figures, you know you've got to do major surgery on Medicare and Medicaid. And obviously, you have to have more revenue if the government is the size that people want. And that can only be done, obviously, by asking people, telling people they got to pay more. And what we did on our panel, and Simpson-Bowles was not dissimilar, we got rid of all the deductions, exemptions, and credits, dramatically reduced the rates, made everybody basically pay a flat tax. And the books do balance, or come close to balance if you do that. But it takes a lot of political courage. And only the president, quite truthfully, can sit down, shut the door, and say, look, we've got to resolve this. Otherwise, we're not going home.
Frank Keating, the former governor of Oklahoma, now the president and CEO of the American Bankers Association. And what is your website?
The website is aba.com, and we would obviously welcome all visitors.
There you go. So you should check it out, aba.com, all right? A lot of questions there, certainly, that we have to face. You can't go overboard, whole hog. You can't print your own money like your favorite uncle can. Absolutely. More to come on to the Jim Bohannon Show at 1-866-50-JIMBO, 1-866-505-4626 as we wend our way through the night. In the Chesapeake, Virginia, George Holscher has bowled a 300 game. Not bad for a paralyzed man who bowls from a wheelchair. Yeah. And here's a sign of the times. Topps Incorporated is removing Bazooka Joe comics from their Bazooka Joe gum. That's outrageous. And more to come. We'll be back. Welcome back to the Jim Bohannon Show at 1-866-50-JIMBO, 1-866-505-4626. Looking forward to our year-in-review program this coming evening. It's been quite a year, even by the standards of contemporary events. This one was jam-packed in many ways. And 2013, boy, the prospects are thunderous. Not as thunderous. TV viewing, the CALM Act, goes into effect. Well, actually has here in the Eastern Time Zone Thursday. CALM stands for Commercial Advertisement Loudness Mitigation. You know how the TV show is going along, and we're going to find out who shot JR, but right now, hey, would you like to buy so-and-so? The TV commercials, they can't blare them at you anymore. Now, actually, the Federal Communications Commission adopted the rules a year ago, but they gave television broadcasters a one-year grace period to adopt them. And you can report suspected violations to the FCC website, which is, I guess, FCC.gov, I'm pretty sure. Now, interestingly, a lot of FCC rules, like content and this sort of thing, saying bleep and blap on the radio, refer more to broadcasters, that is to say people with towers and transmitters, than it does to, say, Internet broadcasting or satellite broadcasting. These rules on loudness will apply to broadcasters and cable and satellite operators. And you have to say, it's about time. It really is that. I mean, honest to goodness, I have seen commercials so loud that I spend the first 15 seconds of the commercials basically yelling at my TV set, I've got news for you. I'm not listening to your pitch, okay? This is self-defeating. You're not selling a thing, okay? If I am grousing about how loud you're yelling at me, I'm not listening to your pitch. This was a dumb idea from day one, and it shouldn't have required this kind of action. But it has, and it's high time. High time. All right. Savannah calls in from Memphis tonight. Hello, Savannah.
Hello. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you.
Well, I'm as fine as duck down.
Well, there you go. Pretty fine.
All mellowed out and ready for the Christmas and everything else.
Oh, yeah.
I finished my shopping in, last present was bought October the 15th.
Well, that's pretty good. You know, again, people don't understand the real value of both the prices and the limited selection. You don't have to go waiting through around 6 p.m. on Christmas Eve. That's when you shop.
I go look for the sales, and they're marking down scented candles and July.
Well, I know people who have done all their Christmas shopping on December the 26th.
I don't buy anything expensive, and I'm not cheap. I just live on a budget, and I stick to it. And if I can't pay cash for it, I don't buy it.
Well, hey, I mean, you're allowed, for Pete's sake, you know.
I don't want those credit card bills coming in January. And that's too much of what Americans do. They're out just getting themselves in debt up to their eyebrows, and then the bills come in.
Yeah, and that's not a good thing. That's not a present to anybody. And since we often give presents to family members, I mean, if you're sinking the whole family's economy, what kind of present is that?
That's not. I'd like to cover two things with you.
Okay.
For one, I like to get my news from the newspaper and the local TV, but I also go online. And Newt Gingrich was being interviewed. Quote, if Hillary Clinton runs for president in 2016, we don't have a Republican candidate who can beat her. End quote.
Well, 4 years is a long time. At this moment, I would suspect that's true, but we're not even certain that Hillary's going to run yet.
Well, you know, they're already working on the next election. A lot of people don't realize how
I guarantee you there are people running. I can tell you who's running. Rick Santorum is running. Governor Cuomo of New York is running. Governor O'Malley of Maryland is running. And there are probably four or five others that could come quickly to mind.
Well, Rubio's...
Rubio, I think, is running. Chris Christie, maybe. I don't know.
Well, and then I'd like to go back to shopping. I am sure that people might know about this, but in cities around the country, small and large, there are charitable organizations, and they got really smart, Jim. What they do is that they get free services. Someone designs the Christmas card, and then they don't charge them for it. And then someone prints the Christmas card. They don't charge them for it because they can take that off their income tax, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And you can send a list of the people that you want to get Christmas cards and addresses and everything. And what you do is make a nominal donation, And that charitable organization sends out exquisite Christmas cards addressed by hand in beautiful handwriting, and they put the stamp on them, and they mail them for you. And the inside says, a generous gift has been given in your name to X charity. Merry Christmas and Happy New Year.
That's a good thing.
It's a good thing, and they make money on it because they didn't have to pay for the cards, they didn't have to pay for the printing, and since they're charitable organizations, I think maybe charitable organizations can mail in mass. I've seen that on cards that come.
You're right, I believe, yeah.
They're not necessarily stamped, so I would encourage everybody, if you're physically responsible like I am, hey, we're always looking for something to deduct from the income tax because that 2013, take care of your business.
You got that right, my dear. Thank you, Savannah. We will take a quick break, and when we come back, another reason the fiscal cliff could hurt. Well, fiscal cliff diving, like Wile E. Coyote, is not going to be a fun thing. It will have impacts that some of us haven't even thought about. We're talking right now with the president and CEO of the American Hospital Association, Richard Umdenstock, about just how this may affect that sector of our economy. First of all, I understand that healthcare has done a pretty good job of providing jobs in our economy right now.
Oh, that's true. Over the past year, hospitals have been adding about 26,000 jobs per month throughout this downturn, that's because, unfortunately, there continues to be an increasing need for healthcare services. More people with chronic conditions, increases in obesity and diabetes and other problems. So hospitals have had to meet that need, and one of the manifestations is that they have provided additional jobs. Hospitals are always the first, second, or third largest employer in their community anyway, but during this downturn, they've actually been adding jobs.
Now, let's say that we fall off the fiscal cliff, which leads to slashes in federal spending across the board, including deep spending cuts to Medicare. Now, what happens from an economic perspective right off the bat?
Well, there's an automatic 2% across-the-board cut to all Medicare payments. So hospitals will receive 2 cents less on every dollar. Now, I know that 2 cents may not sound like a lot, but over a 10-year period, that's about a $40 or $42 billion cut. And that cut comes on top of cuts that hospitals have already been absorbing as part of the Affordable Care Act and other regulatory cuts that have been made since then. So the cumulative effect is going to be quite serious.
Are we talking here about massive layoffs, or is this the kind? Let's say, for example, we go off the fiscal cliff, but say around the end of the first quarter, March the 31st, we have struck a deal, and so retroactively we don't go over the cliff. But in the interim, are those jobs still lost? Because at that time, let's say in January or February, we wouldn't know whether or not there would be a deal down the road.
Well, many hospitals are on a calendar year for their fiscal year, so they've been in the planning and budgeting process since last spring. And certainly this potential cut has been known, so it's been factored into many of the budgets for the coming year. But also, frankly, they've been making adjustments over the last 2 to 3 years as the economic downturn has gone along. So they're been tightening their belts as much as possible, improving care, reducing unnecessary steps in the processes of care and so on all along. But if they do take these additional cuts, they will then have to look at additional jobs and whether or not they can afford to provide particular services. And, you know, that's our job at the AHA. If it looks as though a deal is going to happen, but maybe not happen right away, we try to keep our members up to speed on that so that they can adjust accordingly. But if these cuts go in and stay, then those jobs and services will disappear.
Now, will certain hospitals be affected more than others? I'm thinking, for example, of private hospitals versus public hospitals in areas with a very strong tax base versus public hospitals in areas with a rather low tax base. Will it really have an impact that's across the board?
In the hospital world, we talk about something called payer mix, and that's the mix of different payment sources that patients would bring. So Medicare and Medicaid are the public programs, and those are the cuts that we're talking about at this time. On average, those can be anywhere from 45, 50, 60% of a hospital's budget. The rest would be commercial payments, self-pay, and so on. Private insurance. So the payer mix is key. Typically, safety net hospitals in the inner city have a very high Medicaid and Medicare mix. Rural hospitals tend to have an older population that they serve, so they're a little heavier on the Medicare side.
Mm-hmm.
So it all comes down to that payer mix. And when you experience cuts in public programs, the only thing you can do is shift those costs over to your insured patients, your privately insured patients, Blue Cross or Aetna or others. That's called the cost shift. And employers and patients definitely pushing back on how much more they can absorb. So it all comes down to that mix of payment.
Are the big insurers making any statements beforehand, like we'll go this far and no further?
Well, you can definitely see it in the negotiations going on at the community level between insurers and hospitals. Employers in particular are putting pressure on their insurers, and insurers are putting pressure on hospitals as part of those negotiations.
Hasn't there been a real problem with even getting doctors to accept Medicare and Medicaid patients just by virtue of the level of payments?
Yes, Medicaid has always been a problem. Medicaid is the lowest paying payer, and so many physicians have limited the number of Medicaid patients they will see, but also Medicare. And Medicare has a problem in the formula as to how they pay physicians. And if something's not done to change that by the end of this year, doctors will face a 28-29% cut in their Medicare payments, which obviously is then going to drive many more physicians to limit how many Medicare patients they can take. So that's all part of this mix.
If worse comes to worst, we are seeing a financial impact. I would certainly hope that we're not talking about very ill patients literally being tossed out on the street, are we?
No. Hospitals take care of every patient who presents with a condition. There are lots of laws and regulations to oversee that. But we do have to be honest as a nation. When we talk about cuts to provider payments, it translates into an impact on the patient in terms of what services are offered in a given community. And that will affect all patients, regardless of their payment source. Recent poll shows that patients understand this. Even though politicians might say, well, we're not cutting benefits, patients know that cuts to providers will eventually impact the availability of services. And 7 out of 10 patients said don't cut hospital payments because they know the consequences.
Well, of course, if we were in a mood to be making choices, we wouldn't be having this fiscal cliff anyway. If we'd made choices, we would have decided what areas to cut as opposed to just this ham-fisted across-the-board meat axe.
No, that's right. We're very much in favor of truly reforming the healthcare system and driving costs out of the system while improving quality. America's hospitals are very much in favor of true healthcare reform, but simple cuts to payments doesn't eliminate any costs, and it's not reform. And so that's why we're pushing back on this, while at the same time, hospitals are really reinventing themselves. Just one example, we have over 2,000 hospitals directly engaged in a national quality improvement project that is showing dramatic results in the decrease of infections associated with hospital care, readmissions back to the hospital within 30 days of discharge, and a variety of other outcome indicators. So hospitals and their care getting better all the time, and that's reducing costs. But simply cutting payments is not reforming the system.
Yeah, which brings up another interesting topic, and that is, as hospitals are strapped for cash, would there not be an overwhelming temptation to cut a few corners and therefore lead to a return to higher incidences of infections and other such problems? I mean, not that anybody wants to do that, but if the feds say no and the insurance companies say no more, and let's say you don't get a local property tax increase for the public hospitals, then what else can you do? Either you cut corners or you shut down.
Well, many payers, including Medicare, pay hospitals on a fixed amount per case. So they learn to live within that fixed amount of money. Now what they're saying is that if you have some sort of complication that is associated with that hospital care, like an infection or another readmission, we're not going to pay you again. We're not going to pay you any more. So it really isn't in anybody's interest to do anything but get it right the first time, because then those much more substantial costs will come back on the hospital and not be paid for under these new rules. So definitely the incentives are to do exactly what the patient needs and get the best possible outcome in that first episode.
Rich Umdenstock, he is the president and CEO of the American Hospital Association, and you are online at what website?
www.aha.org.
aha.org. We'll be right back.
Gentlemen's clothes are smart, the gentleman's all the rage. He set for love from hat to glove, but the gentleman needs a shave.
Those wacky folks at J&D Foods are back with some new stuff you'd never have thought of, including some based on sriracha, that hot sauce from Thailand.
They start with sriracha-flavored popcorn, so really kind of hot and spicy pre-made popcorn. And then from there, launched most recently sriracha lip balm. And it's really kind of like just putting SPF 15 napalm on your lips.
I can hardly wait. But, of course, J&D Foods is best known for making bacon-flavored stuff like lip balm, and now you can't be serious.
That is, yes, real quality shaving cream. It smells like bacon.
We're talking a Christmas gift for that person really hard to shop for who wants to smell like breakfast a long time.
The heat-activated bacon scent technology is good for all day. I mean, you should have a solid 8 to 10 hours of bacon aroma coming off you.
So don't even try covering it up.
This is really a high-quality product. No aftershave is going to be needed.
Just maybe Vicks Vapor Rub. Learn more at jdfoods.net. And not just men.
You know, there's a lot of women out there. You can shave anything that you want, any part of your body you want. This is the product to do it if you're looking to smell like, well, pork.
Ooh, so many punchlines, so many station licenses to lose. And speaking of women and bacon,
they're just these really fun fake roses that smell like bacon.
Oh, that'll win the heart of that special short-order cook in your life. Plus, for any other occasion where you need to be fakin' bacon.
We're bringing the 80s back. You know, right out of the scrap heap of 80s pop culture comes bacon-smelling stickers. And we're shipping a couple of them free with every online order that anybody places at jdfoods.net through the holidays.
Again, jdfoods.net. These bacon-smelling items are that ideal Christmas gift for that person you really hate, along with a pass to go hiking in Yellowstone Park's grizzly country. Just a thought. Little something for special caring there. Be sure to go to JimboTalk.net and click on our poll. We'd like to know how you think the fiscal cliff plunge will end. A comprehensive deal, short-term deal, no deal but the deadline, but a retroactive bailout, or here we go! Just go to JimboTalk.net, click on our poll. Our producer and webmaster is Mr. Paul Hill, and our engineer would be Bill Pimble. Our year-in-review program coming up this coming evening, so join us for that, won't you? I'm Jimbo Hannon on the Dial Global Radio Networks.